Welcome into the KSRO Kitchen. I'm Steve Garner, along with a surprise guest. And I'll see if you can guess who this surprise guest is. In his first book, 1991, the Brother Juniper's Bread book, Slow Rise is Method and Metaphor, the first person he thanks at the end of the book is my co-host for the show.
Who's that?
John Ash. Brother Juniper, Peter Reinhardt, thanks John Ash.
That's right.
The first person on your first book.
That's
and
right.
It's inscribed here to Steve. May your bread always rise. Peter Reinhardt, September 18th, 1991, Santa Rosa, California. Welcome back to the homeland, the fatherland.
Yes, it's like deja vu all over again.
Well, we're going to do something fun today. We're going to do a retrospect of your career. This is your life, Peter Reinhardt. There's a lot of books, a lot of travel, a lot of teaching, a lot of learning that you've gone through from those early days back in the 1980s when you had the cafe out in Forestville.
That's right.
And you started at the cafe in the mid to early 80s baking out there?
I think we opened in 1986. Mm-hmm. And my wife, Susan, and I owned the cafe, and which eventually became a bakery. And we owned it until the mid-90s, and then we sold it, and I started teaching from that point on and continued to write. Kind of a whole new career opened up as a result of those early days. And the reason I thank John in the book is because he was the first guy to buy my bread and use it in his restaurant. And when the bread was, once the word got out that he was using my bread at his restaurant, our sales took off.
That's great.
So he launched me.
So how did baking? I mean, you always baked, but it wasn't you're a wonderful chef. Also, I mean, you do things other than make bread.
Yeah, we had this cafe. I knew how to cook. I was cooking for a number of years in a seminary. I was living in the seminary of the brother, the Christ the Savior Brotherhood out here in headquarters was in Forestville. And I was part of that brotherhood. And my wife, Susan, was the cook at the retreat center that we had there. So that's how we met. She was the cook, and I liked to cook. I had had a restaurant right from my college days. And so I was always in the kitchen hanging out. And before you know it, we were courting and sparking and everything else. And we decided right before we got married, which was a crazy idea, but right before we got married, we had to open a little cafe in the town of Forestville. And it was a chance to try out a lot of our food ideas, one of which was bread, which I'd been baking for fun as an amateur, entering him in the Sonoma County Harvest Fair. That's how I got the bread thing launched, was by winning ribbons at the fair, and it grew from there.
And you even moved back further to 1988 when you won the Cotati Garlic Festival.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right?
We made a stromboli, a garlic stromboli, and the judge was the owner of the publishing house. What was it called? He wrote the book, The Book of Garlic, and he owned a publishing house. And he asked me if he could republish the recipe.
John Harris.
John Harris of Aris Books. Yeah. And John was very nice, and he said, "Can I publish this recipe in my next edition of the book?" And I said, "Sure, but would you do me a favor and look at something I wrote and tell me if you think it has potential as a book?" And so he did. And a week later, he called me. He says, "It was just a chapter I gave him." He says, "Do you think you could extend this into a whole book?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I'd like to do the book." And that's how I got Brother Juniper's Bread book.
Just by being at the Cotati Garlic Festival in 1988. And then a year later, things really exploded because you were featured in the New York Times.
That's right.
In 1989.
Yeah, unexpectedly, a reporter came by and then wrote about us in the Times. And again, our place was just tiny little place. MFK Fisher was still alive then, living here in Sonoma, and she became a fan of the bread and invited us out. In fact, John and I, we went out there and had dinner with her one night. And so there was so much going on. I mean, everything was just sort of happening unexpectedly, and it was all because of bread. For me, it seemed like bread was the door opener for everything.
But don't you think it was food in general? I mean, we sort of forget, we take for granted now that we've got all these wonderful ingredients and, you know, very shishi kinds of concoctions of things.
Sure.
But it was pretty simple back then. Yeah. And the whole idea of getting good bread was just off the chart.
Yeah, and we were just in the right place at the right time because Sonoma County was the center of so much. I mean, this is almost anything that you can think of regarding food could happen here, whether it was coastal, whether it was in the hills, whatever, the grapes, the wine, everything. Cheese, we were at the first goat cheese festival. And,
in 1991. I mean,
yeah, it was the beginning of kind of a whole new
explosion. So why did you move away?
Well, that was a good question. And part of it was that our families are from back east. Both Susan and I are from the Philadelphia area, but our families were both back east, and we were starting to lose family members, and it was a pretty big production to go back each time. And so we felt like it was maybe time to just get back closer to them, and I got a great job offer at Johnson & Wales University. By then I was teaching bread making at the California Culinary Academy, and they offered me a full-time position there, and that's actually, you know, along with the CIA, the two great culinary schools were Johnson & Wales and CIA, so I got to move back there, first to Providence, and then later, 4 years later, they opened a campus in Charlotte, North Carolina, which was where we really wanted to go, because Susan's family had moved to the Carolinas, and I've been there now, believe it or not, for 14 years.
Wow.
It just seems like yesterday.
Yeah.
So 14 the brother, years and four books ago.
Yeah.
The Brother Juniper's bread book that debuted, the Struan recipe, the bread, but which is still, I think, your favorite
still
bread.
Still my favorite bread, Struan, yeah.
And there seems to always be a different iteration of the Struan in every book that you do.
That's right. To me, it's not only my favorite bread, but it's kind of the metaphor of metaphors for me, because I talk about bread always as a metaphor, but I say, you know, the Struan bread, which is the harvest bread, and it consists of about 12 ingredients, is kind of like the metaphor of who I am, of my life, a convergence. The translation of the word Struan means a convergence of streams. And when I learned that, and that was after I'd been making the bread, and I went to Scotland and found out what it meant, I realized that that's why I loved the bread so much, is that it defined my whole life as being sort of this convergence of many different you know, unexpected streams kind of coming together in unexpected ways.
And then there was this chapter, and then there was Struan.
And then, there was Struan.
And then there's the blessing of the Struan.
Right.
All of this, and you're just the most charming, wonderful debut book imaginable. The Brother Juniper's
and it was it also was approachable. I mean, you have that great gift of being able to teach people to do things and explain them in ways that, because a lot of bread books are pretty, you know, they're a
little technical,
impenetrable.
Yeah, and of course it was before that came out, before bread got really, like, we got really scientific about understanding the ratios of ingredients and all. That came a little bit later when the Bread Bakers Guild of America was formed, and I got to be in the early stages of that and study with some of these European bread masters. And all the things that I had figured out intuitively and through trial and error, they put some science behind it, and that's what opened up the teaching career. And with the background in ministry that I had, the idea of communicating and teaching, you know, all these things to students, not just to teach them how to make bread, but sort of, again, as a door opener for understanding life, it all fit. It was a convergence of streams that led to a career that has been carrying me ever since. I feel like I ride the Struan horse, you know, into each new situation.
Well, it certainly didn't hurt that you were billed as Brother Peter Reinhardt. I think that was very eye-catching on the front of the book, and the book has very down-to-earth spiritual principles that you live by, plus a zany bit of humor chapter connecting with the sticky bun zeitgeist, things like this. So it was a serious topic, but you certainly didn't take the topic seriously.
Well, I had fun with it, you know, for sure, because you have to. In fact, you know, at our restaurant, at the time when we still had Brother Juniper's Cafe, we were known in addition to our bread for our barbecue and our barbecue sauce, and we were selling the jars of barbecue sauce, and we were trying to figure out when we first started putting it out there in bottles what to call it. And my mother's case said, I have an idea, why don't you call it Holy Smoke, because of your religious background. And I said, well, that's a little bit profane. And she said, yeah, but it's just barbecue sauce. And I said, you're right. You know? And that became the name.
And your mother proved to be your best PR person, didn't she?
She had actually been a professional publicist in Philadelphia. So she knew all the ins and outs. So she was giving me great advice all the time. Like with her, one of her, as for a writer, one of her best pieces of advice is, anytime you go by a bookstore, always go in, see if they have your books, and sign them when they're there, because if you sign them, they won't send them back to the publisher if they don't sell.
That's what you need. The second book followed in 1994. Here it is, Sacramento Magic in a Small Town Cafe, Recipes and Stories from Brother Juniper's Cafe. This was really more of a cookbook, and I think Susan had a lot to do with your wife with this book.
Yeah, a lot of her recipes are in this book. Together, the two of us created all the recipes for the cafe, and when we decided that we had to, she injured her back. She wasn't going to be able to continue working in it, you know, we had just grown the bakery and everything to such a much larger size than we ever imagined. We had moved to Santa Rosa in the old taco tortilla factory on Sebastopol Road. And all of a sudden we had this big business. And
Sebastopol Avenue.
Sebastopol Avenue, yeah, sorry.
Which is off Santa Rosa Avenue.
Correct. And what I understand is now a very trendy, artsy.
There's another bakery there.
This bakery there. And I see the Spinster Sisters are right there. Yeah. Thinking, boy, if I were still there, I could be the elder statesman.
It's actually funny. It's apropos nothing, but the bakery is called Criminal Bakery.
Criminal Bakery, right. How ironic. so we realized that it had gotten too big for us. That my background wasn't in business. It was more in communications and ministry and service. And so we decided to sell it. And one of the things we promised the people in Forestville who wanted us to keep our cafe open was that I would leave behind at least the recipes. So as our, you know, sort of a thank you for everything. So I wrote that book, and it was a way to get all the recipes and more things that we hadn't even made at the restaurant, but in one place for them. And I got to tell stories, which is what I really
liked
to do.
What was the recipe out of that book? I mean, I think I know what it was.
The recipe from that book that kind of popped?
Yeah.
I'll tell you the one that we get the most, even today, and the book is now out of print, but the people who have it, I still get emails from people saying, my favorite recipe from that book was the coleslaw. I love the coleslaw.
So here's what I was, before you said that, John, I was going to say that Peter and I did not bond over bread. We bonded over coleslaw. Mm. You remember?
Coleslaw.
We went toe-to-toe with our coleslaw recipe.
And also a Caesar salad was another one.
Caesar. And you have a chapter here called The Coleslaw Reaction Revisited, right?
Yeah.
Where you really dissect the nuances of great coleslaw. And a lot of people don't take coleslaw seriously. Maybe I take it too seriously, but
you should. I think it's profound. Right to take it seriously.
I think it's a profound side dish and should be relegated higher.
And there's so much bad coleslaw out there, especially when you go to barbecue places that have great barbecue, and you go, how come you can make great barbecue, but you don't know how to make coleslaw?
Yeah.
And they just go, well, this is how I've always made it. Mm-hmm. I said, do you ever eat it?
We've covered two. We have about five or six more. Yeah.
Was there a recipe that you were thinking of from that book?
I think it was the...
Was it the chili?
The chili recipe.
Oh, well, there was...
That, I mean, that was the one that sticks in my mind.
I had a problem with the chili recipe in the book because the publisher, when we proofread the book, it all looked right. But when it came out, there was an ingredient missing from it.
Oh, no.
And right at the bottom of the page of ingredients, there's supposed to be like a tablespoon or something of cumin seeds. Because we didn't say use chili powder. It said we gave the ingredients to make your own chili spices. And cumin's so critical to good chili. Mm. And it wasn't there. And I'm thinking, gosh, anybody who makes this chili is going to say, what's so great about this chili? You know, and so everywhere I went, I had to like write it in and put my initials next to it. And eventually we printed up little sheets of paper to put in the books.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
It's the exuberant.
I love that chili.
Chef Peter Reinhardt, Brother Juniper, we know him as, a homegrown here in Santa Rosa. It's delightful to have him back in the KSRO kitchen. We're going to explore his vast repertoire of great writing, great awards, and just a wonderful friend of the show. I'm Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash. This is KSRO.
Hello, Sonoma County. I'm Digital Pro Kim Commando, and I'm here Sundays, noon to 3 on KSRO.
No one likes to live with the mess and inconvenience of home improvement projects. That's why Milgard makes it so easy for you to replace your old, drafty, hard-to-open windows. Often it takes less than a day to improve the look and value of your home with reliable, energy-efficient Milgard replacement windows. Milgard's dependable delivery means you get the right windows at the right time. And because most jobs use your existing frames and openings, it minimizes the mess. Plus, you don't have to worry about disposing of your old windows. Milgard makes it easy to get home improvement done. Call DJ's Sash and Glass today for Milgard Windows. DJ's can furnish and install a variety of shower door enclosures too. Add a touch of class to your glass with DJ's Sash and Glass. 2985 Wilton Court. Call 546-7344 and online at djsglass.com.
Hey, homeowners, this is George Adair with Bay Equity Home Loans. Now you can finally benefit from the housing recovery. For a free home value analysis, call Bay Equity at 707-583-8100. Maybe now you can knock out some of those home improvement projects, like adding a new roof, kitchen, or flooring. You can even add solar with a cash-out refinance. Do you still have high credit card payments? Use your home's equity at a low fixed mortgage to get rid of that expensive debt and sleep well again. Bay Equity can help you celebrate the housing recovery. Treat yourself to improving your home or reduce your credit card balances with a cash out refinance from Bay Equity Home Loans. To see if you qualify, call Bay Equity at 707-583-8100. Again, 583-8100, or go online to bayequityloans.com.
Equal housing lender subject to credit approval. NMLS ID 76988. The transaction will be made pursuant to the Department of Business Oversight California Finance Lender Law and our California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. NMLS ID 245370.
I'm Dane Lobb. I'm a public safety specialist with PG&E. If you're in your home or business and you smell gas, your first step is to get out. Travel to a safe distance until you can't smell the gas anymore and then call 911. The first responders will come out and they'll make it safe for you and your community.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
I visit with Peter Reinhardt, Brother Peter Reinhardt, for those of you. I remember him. I can hear so many people saying that. Eating the wonderful Brother Juniper's bread and dining in the Forestville Cafe. And probably you own at least one or two of his great bread books. So we started in 91 with the Brother Juniper's bread book, then the Sacramental Magic in a Small Town Cafe book. That's 1994. And then we jump up about 4 years to 1998 for Crust and Crumb. Talk a little bit about Crust and Crumb. This was a very important book to me because it changed my biscuit making life.
Remember we talked about
Blitz biscuits.
Yes.
And being a Southern boy, I got biscuits in my blood. Mm-hmm. But I had never thought to laminate biscuits, to use the fold method, until I read your book.
Yeah, and I'm not sure where I came up with that part of it, but the basic recipe itself was inspired by Marion Cunningham, who was the author of the Fanny Farmer book, the great Marion Cunningham, who also had founded the local group of bakers called the Baker's Dozen. Mm-hmm. And so Marion brought that recipe one day and showed everybody how a simple recipe could be so good. And then from then I came up with this other step, which was to roll it and fold it like you would a croissant to get extra layers so that when it bakes, it would open up like an accordion. And
folding over or pleating, they call it.
And then you fold and then you roll it. And then finally, by the time you cut it into biscuits, and it wasn't drop biscuits, but it was a firmer dough, you would cut them and they would just open up beautifully and be flaky. So we were looking for a flaky biscuit. And I just loved it. And it was so simple. And I think, of, like a lot of the recipes in many great cookbooks, it's the simple ones that people love. And remember, first of all, those are the ones they're going to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, how many people actually cook the recipes from cookbooks? They usually will choose the ones that look easy to do. So when you can do that, it happens. And then this book itself was important for me because it's the first book that actually had color photography.
Yeah.
And it won a James Beard Award unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. It went up I was up against two like giants in my category, Pierre Hermé, whose book had just won the IACP Book of the Year Award. So I figured I had no chance at the James Beards. And Rose Levy Bierenbaum had her book, The Pastry Bible, not the Cake Bible, but The Pastry Bible. And so I figured I'd just go for the trip. I got to go to New York, rent a tuxedo, and I'm sitting here. And the book had originally been bought by a publishing house, HarperCollins, but then they had a whole bunch of internal changes. And after I wrote it and they paid for it, they actually gave it back to me and said, we're not going to publish it because we decided it's not going to sell enough copies. And so then they had this decision had been made to jettison 100 different books that they had bought. So I called 10 Speed Press here in Berkeley, and I knew that they had wanted to work with me. And I said, I think I have a book for you, and it won't cost you very much because I'd already got paid for it. I said, if you promise to put the color photography back in and you know do the original vision I had for the book, and they did. And when I won the best part of the story is when they announced my name for winning the James Beard, and I stood up, I was sitting right in front of the editor from the other publishing house who had turned the book away. And I got to kind of stand there just for a couple of extra seconds, you know, and go, okay, I made my point.
Sweet revenge.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
So could you talk for a second about, for people who don't know, what it means, and it's changed a lot, to deal with publishers, because it's changed mightily. It used to be that it was kind of a joy and they would put some money behind it for promotion and things like that, which they don't do anymore.
That's true. And it's, the publishing game has changed dramatically, obviously. And even there's fear among the agents and in publishing. Like every day it's a new game. Digital publishing, self-publishing, all that has changed the game. And it's made it possible for a lot of people to get published. So it's opened it up and democratized it.
Can I ask you an impertinent question?
Yeah,
so
sure.
Does the world need another cookbook, bread book, baking book? I mean, there are so many.
I have so many books in my personal library. Yeah. Cookbooks, though, do have probably more shelf life than other books. People like to hold them, look at them. It seems to be, you know, still a category that's relevant. But you go, okay, what can you say that hasn't been said before? And yet some people come up with new stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. The Ottolenghi and all these guys, they keep, you know, breaking new ground. The modernist bread.
The Nathan Mirvold.
Nathan Mirvold.
And you worked on that.
I'm an editor on that book. I got to play a role. I wasn't in a position to be able to take a co-authorship role, which we talked about with Nathan, but he found Francisco Magoya, who is a phenomenal baker and pastry chef out of the Culinary Institute of America. He was ready to go out and do something, and he moved to Seattle and took charge of the baking team there and wrote most of the text. And it's a beautiful, incredible 5-volume, $625 book. And you go, who's going to buy that? Well, they said that about modernist cuisine 6 years ago, and now it's in 12 languages, and they can't keep it in print. And so people still seem to want books, and this is a rare thing. I mean, it took an independently wealthy person who loved food, who didn't care whether it was successful or not, to create it. And as a result, he basically forged an entire new genre of publishing. Who knows what'll come next?
We'll take a break at that point. So Crust and Crumb, we're leaving off there in 1998. When we return, we'll jump into the 21st century and follow Peter Reinhardt's continued publishing and baking exploits. He's Brother Juniper, and he's with John Ash and me in the KSRO kitchen this morning. We'll be back after this.
FM News Talk Radio, North County 103.5, South County 94.5, KSRO.
Come to the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, voted Best Farmers Market. You'll find garden starts from La Vida Buena Nursery, Savor Farm fresh eggs and produce like fresh strawberries, avocados, and Humble Roots organic sprouts. Enjoy farm-to-table almonds, walnuts, and healthy salad greens. Discover quality beef, pork, fresh seafood, and freshly made sausages. Multiple food vendors are serving up an excellent breakfast and lunch using farm fresh products. Minhee's Korean cuisine, Eli's authentic Mexican food, Mi Fiesta's fresh tamales, and a whole lot more. Santa Rosa's original certified farmers market at Luther Burbank Center for the Arts is open year-round, Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 to 1 p.m. Thank you, Sonoma County, for voting them number one, the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun. Come to the Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, voted Best Farmers Market. You'll find garden starts from La Vida Buena Nursery, Savor Farm fresh eggs and produce like fresh strawberries, avocados, and Humble Roots organic sprouts. Enjoy farm-to-table almonds, walnuts, and healthy salad greens. Discover quality beef, pork, fresh seafood, and freshly made sausages. Multiple food vendors are serving up an excellent breakfast and lunch using farm fresh products. Minhee's Korean cuisine, Eli's authentic Mexican food, Mi Fiesta's fresh tamales, and a whole lot more. Santa Rosa's original certified farmers market at Luther Burbank Center for the Arts is open year-round, Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 to 1 p.m. Thank you, Sonoma County, for voting them number one, the Santa Rosa original certified farmers market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun.
in the KSRO kitchen, a retrospect with Brother Peter Reinhardt, the baker extraordinaire who really started his career in Santa Rosa. Many of you enjoyed his breads for many, many years, or enjoyed the cafe out in Forestville in the 80s and early 90s. He moved back to the Johnson & Wales Culinary School in Providence, Rhode Island, and then down to Charlotte, North Carolina. He's still teaching there, still writing books. And didn't you own an interest in a pizzeria back there?
Yes, because one of my books that we haven't talked about yet that came out later was about pizza, and we'll get to that.
We're not up to that yet.
I know, we're going to, but as a result of that book, I've gotten a lot of opportunities to, to work with local pizzerias to help them with their recipes, and one group brought me in as a creative partner, and I helped launch them, and they're doing quite well. It's called Pure Pizza. It's kind of a farm to table pizzeria. And also, one of the things that helped me kind of, while I was still living here, helped me get to that next level, was doing some product development for Amy's Kitchen, the amazing Santa Rosa based company, and I worked on the pizzas for them at the beginning, and helped them develop those doughs, and that sort of got me a whole lot of other side work.
2001. I think this may still be considered your seminal work.
Yeah.
The Bread Baker's Apprentice, Mastering the Art of Extraordinary Bread. It won both Best Cookbook of the Year at the James Beard Society, and it also won Best Cookbook of the Year the Julia Child IACP. That's quite a tour de force.
It has the most extraordinary cover.
Yeah.
Now, who is that young woman?
Yes, we have a cover. On the cover is a student. She was a freshman in my bread class at the time. She's from Tokyo, Japan, named Fumi Shibazaki, and the sweetest girl in the world. And she was just helping us with the photo shoot for the book. We were shooting all of them at Johnson & Wales. And there was one loaf of bread, a big giant loaf of bread that wasn't that attractive by itself, but we were trying to get a shot, and so the photographer asked her to move it to another place, and when she lifted it and was holding it and kind of cradling it, he said freeze, and he took a shot of her, and he looked at me and he says, I think we just got
it. Was that serendipitous?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just totally unplanned. And she's got this sort of like Mona Lisa like smile. In fact, after the book came out, she became known as the Mona Lisa of bread. And the cool thing is, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, is that 15 years later now, this book's been out 15 years. We did an updated version, and we have a picture of her 15 years later in the back cover. So.
Oh, you do? Yeah. Oh, I haven't seen the update.
She's now the executive pastry chef for Danny Meyer at the his cafe in Tokyo. Union Square Cafe, Tokyo. Yeah. And she works for him there.
Wow.
And I was able to get her to take a picture. Now she's holding a loaf of bread. It's kind of almost like an icon. Was the idea there. But in the new picture, we have her 15 years later with her 5-year-old nephew on her knee, holding a loaf of bread like that one. So we got this generational thing.
Cool.
Yeah, going.
That's very cool.
Oh, that's absolutely beautiful. You went to France and studied at Léon Apollon Bakery, did you not?
I got to interview him and spend time with him and a number of bakers there. Well, as a result of Crust and Crumb, actually, while I was in San Francisco, I won a bread competition for the James Beard Society. And the prize was to go to France for a week to study with any baker of my choice. And I asked them if I could instead of spending 5 days with one baker, if I could do 5 bakers one day each. So I got to meet Poilane, and that was very important because he's such an important figure in bread. But also I met an unknown baker named Philippe Gosselin, who had developed a technique of cold fermentation using a dough that it was totally against the rules of baguette making for France. It was his method and nobody took him seriously because everybody there learned a particular accepted way of doing baguettes. And then in 1995, he won the award for best baguette in Paris. And then all of a sudden, everybody's going, oh, who are you? Well, he taught me his method, and I created sort of a home version of that. And that became the centerpiece of Bread Baker's Apprentice. We call it the pain à l'ancienne, which was, he called it that because it looks like an ancient style bread because it has a lot of flour on it. It's not a bread that could have been made in ancient times because it requires refrigeration. So it's kind of a play on words, but it's a great technique. And that technique, I think, is what led the way to things like the New York Times French bread recipe that Jim Leahy developed, all the mm-hmm. all the breads now that are wet doughs, overnight fermentation. Mm-hmm. I think this is the first time we talked about that.
The no-knead came out.
Yeah, yeah, the no-knead thing. Yeah. All of that started with this pain à l'ancienne, and it totally changed my perspective on bread making, and a number of books that I did after that were based on specifically on that technique. Mm.
So this was a seminal book sales-wise, but also in your formative your philosophy about bread. You moved to a different level
Took me to another place. And again, all these things were just, I would say I didn't intend any of this. I just followed the breadcrumb trail and wherever it led me. And it just led me to some pretty cool places.
We stopped for a moment at, 2003. And that's the American Pie book, My Search for the Perfect Pizza.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
And did you actually go around the country looking for best pizza?
I went around the country. I went to Italy. We went to Italy and did a tour through Italy to kind of get to the roots of pizza itself, both northern style like focaccia and the schiacciata of Tuscany, and then eventually, of course, to Naples and that style in Rome. And then to a number of places in the United States, but you couldn't go to every place that there is, although there are people that have tried it since. But we found the idea of that book was to find out what was the secret between good and great. That's really the subtext, is the difference between good and great. And I finally, came to a couple conclusions, one of which is that first you have to say, well, what's great? I think that I came up with the definition of greatness when it comes to pizza or anything in this realm is it memorable, mm-hmm. memorable in an indelible good way. And there are pizzerias and pizza bakers who have, separated from the pack. Mm-hmm. And yet they're using the same ingredients, flour, water, mm-hmm. salt, yeast, sauce, cheese. So what are they doing different? And that's what I wanted to get to. Mm-hmm. And why were there some pizzerias that touched people in a way that became such a major part of their life, and elicited so much passion in people.
And you start a pizza blog?
And then a few years later, we to keep the story going, we now continue it. We call it Pizza Quest, pizzaquest.com, and we have videos, and we've got to interview. A lot of places hadn't opened when the book came out in 03 or 04.
03, huh?
Yeah. Nancy Silverton opened Pizzeria Mozza a few years mm-hmm. later, which has emerged as, I'd say, one of the three greatest pizzerias in America, maybe in the world. Wow. It's phenomenal.
So you and I had a chance to go to Chris
Bianca's yeah, that's right.
place.
Yeah. In Phoenix, we all went.
And before it was well known.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We were
and that was
there.
Before anybody,
yeah.
before he was and on it, Jimmy Kimmel. Yeah.
And it was like Phoenix?
Yeah, right. Why Phoenix? Yeah, right. And which goes to show you can happen anywhere.
Yeah.
Of course, he's not from Phoenix, but he settled there. Yeah. But and then he proved that you can make great pizza without having New York City water yeah. and everything else. But and so he certainly was the star of the American Pie, because he embodies so many of the the values and the inner fire that define the difference between good mm-hmm. and great. And so the interview with him in the book, I think, is the most important part, where he talks about how, when I asked him what are some of the tricks that he has that make his pizza so much better than everyone else's, and he said, everybody has tricks. He said, but I would be doing anybody a disservice if I taught them my tricks. He said, I can teach people how to, all my tricks, but I can't teach them to care as much as I care. Mm. And that was sort of, that was the phrase that jumped off the page. Mm. And when he said that, I said, I knew I had a book at that point.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And then in 2005, an update of the Brother Juniper's bread book came out.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. We did a reprint of that, and they changed the cover, which I didn't like. I loved the original cover so much, and I didn't love the new cover. But it got some more sales for the book. I updated some of the recipes. That book's now out of print as well. The Brother Juniper's bread book's now a collector's item.
There's only, on eBay.
But you can find it.
But I'm hoping to, now that we can do self-publishing, my plan is as soon as things slow down a little bit, is to bring it out again in a new edition, but do it myself.
When we come back, we'll cover the last three books of Peter's, 2007, 2009, 2014, and see what's on the horizon. Brother Peter Reinhardt is in the KSRO kitchen today. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash. This is KSRO.
Traffic on the fives and weather six times an hour, mornings on FM News Talk Radio, KSRO.
Real estate agents come and go in Sonoma County. The ones who stick around know things the dabblers don't. Mike Kelly's been selling real estate full-time right here since 1978. If you want the Mike Kelly difference, you gotta call Mike.
I was born to sell real estate.
His first words were location, location, location. Mike Kelly knows things the dabblers don't.
I can build a custom strategic plan to sell your home faster for more money with less hassle.
Mike's got specialized market knowledge to help you set the right price for your home. Unmatched Sonoma County connections to find qualified buyers fast, and the online and offline tools that really work.
Show me your home and I'll show you three easy tips to make it look better to buyers, even if you don't use me.
Sell your home faster for more money with less hassle. If you want the Mike Kelly difference, you've got to call Mike. Call the Mike Kelly team today, 707-322-8503.
Creams Towing, this is Arlene.
You know Creams Towing for cars, but Creams Towing can handle even the biggest jobs. Need a motorhome towed? Call Creams. Are you a rancher that needs large equipment moved? Tractors or horse transport trailers are no problem for Creams Towing.
Just call Arlene at Creams, 588-1250. Creams Towing, this is Arlene. With competitive rates and certified Class A drivers, Creams can tow 24/7. They can handle rollovers, heavy-duty accident recovery, and winch out.
Are you a Class A driver looking for a great company to work for? Interested in learning the towing business? Creams is expanding and wants to add several drivers. With the largest fleet of medium and heavy-duty transport vehicles in the area, including a state-of-the-art 50-ton wrecker, you'll learn from the best. Openings for Class A and C. Creams will teach the right candidates.
Be a hero on the highway. Call Creams, 588-1250.
811 is a free service to keep our community safe. Before you do any project, big or small, PG&E will come out and mark your gas and electric lines so you don't hit them when you dig. Call 811 before you dig and make sure that you and your neighbors are safe.
A retrospect with Peter Reinhardt. I mean, we'll be doing another one in 10, 20 years with Peter Reinhardt.
Right.
Well, hopefully.
On the the longest running cooking show in America, in the world.
I think it is.
It is, almost. At this point.
Yeah. Well, one time you used to say we're the longest running west of the Mississippi, but I think now you're nationwide.
It could be east of the Mississippi, too. Yeah. We're up to 2007, and I hold in my hand Peter Reinhardt's Whole Grain Breads, New Techniques, Extraordinary Flavor. And this book, again, another departure, really tackling, well, there was another Struan recipe, I think, in here.
Yeah, the whole grain version, 100% whole grain version, yeah.
So what was the focus of this book? Obviously, whole grains.
Yes.
But why? What was different about this
book? Well, there was, of course, 10, 15 years ago, again, one of those cycles where bread was on the bullseye of everybody.
Right.
And it looked like people were asking, is bread dead and everything else? And one of the things that all the bread bakers realize is that if we're going to keep bread relevant, and it's never going to go away, but how to keep it relevant? Well, we want people to eat more whole grains. It's just the better way to do it. But the reason that most people don't is because it's hard to make a whole grain bread that tastes as good as a white flour bread. White flour is like candy. It's like it's all natural sugar, basically. So how do you top that? And so my goal was to, again, trying to kind of keep one step ahead of the trend, because at this point I realized that there were enough bread books teaching people how to do the basics. So I keep asking myself, well, what's next? What's the next thing that hasn't been covered yet? And because I don't want to just do what everybody else is doing. So I started to use some of the techniques we've been learning from these great baking masters, using pre-ferments and starters and what we call soakers, mm-hmm. and all different ways to fulfill what I had kind of come to coin the term the baker's mission, which is to evoke the full potential of flavor trapped in the grain, regardless of what kind of bread. That's the baker's goal, and the one who does it best wins, as far as customers. So the question was, how do you do that with the whole grains? And I started using some techniques that brought together like two or three different kinds of starters. A soaker that starts enzyme activity, and a starter that's made with yeast or sourdough that gets acidity going, and then put them all together in a final dough. And it took a while to kind of figure out a method. I basically was creating a new method. I called it the epoxy method, because you're taking two pieces of dough that really can't by themselves make bread. There's something missing. But when you put them together, they're stronger than the sum of the parts. And it led to some really cool recipes. And we were able to build a whole book around this and keep it in the whole grain category. And now, of course, everybody's doing whole grain breads everywhere, as it should be, because that's the healthier way to eat.
This was amazing. 55-plus recipes, 350 testers.
Oh, yeah. That was one. That was an experiment. I used. By then, we had the internet, you know, so I was able to, instead of waiting for people to email write me back their reviews and tests, they would, you know, I used to have 20, 30 people test recipes. I just put the word out through the internet, And everybody started, so we had a spreadsheet going, and people would send back their, I was able to email the recipes to them, and we were able to find, by having that many people testing, and not everybody tested every recipe, but by having 20 or 30 or 40 reports coming in, you start to see certain trends, and you start to realize that there's a certain way I'm saying something that's not clear. Everybody's noticing that this is unclear or needs clarification, or something didn't quite work. And so we were able to fix a lot of things, you know, ahead of time by having that many eyes on the page. But it took a lot of work. There were times when I was up all night just reading the emails coming in.
So from 2007, we go to 2009, and here's Peter Reinhardt's Artisan Breads Every Day, fast and easy recipes for world-class breads. I think it's the first time I saw fast.
I know. We had a little struggle over whether to use that word or not. You know,
because it's not really fast. I mean, maybe so.
Well,
you tell me.
Well, what makes it fast is that I took that method of the overnight cold fermentation from the pan alla ancien bread and applied it to breads that were traditionally made in a different way, you know, using starters and sponges and you spread out the fermentation over many, many hours. But if you can make a dough on one day and then go to sleep and wake up the next day, it's as if time has stopped and you've been able to just keep going. And so we use the long, slow fermentation in a refrigerator to take the place of a long, slow fermentation that you have to keep your eye on. And it took a while to kind of figure out how to apply that method to breads that weren't normally made that way, but we found ways to do it. So the fast part is that, you know, you're not having to spend as much time supervising your bread.
Fussing.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. We were watching. Yeah. And you let time and temperature do the work for you.
Another beautiful book, Peter Reinhardt's Artisan Breads Every Day. Now we move up to 2014. This tackled head on everything in the past few years that's been going on in the bread revolution. And that's what it's called, Bread Revolution, world-class baking with sprouted and whole grains, heirloom flours, and fresh techniques. Mm-hmm. Isn't this what's been going on the past few years?
So it begs the question.
Yeah.
What about gluten-free?
Well, I did do it. We skipped over a gluten-free book. Because the last time I was on with you, Steve, live here, was when we had written the book, The Joy of Gluten-Free, Sugar-Free Baking.
Yeah. Yes.
And with that, I had a co-author who actually pioneered a technique of using a seed and nut flours in place of rice flour and other gluten. The more common gluten-free approach, we created our own approach using, and they were low glycemic breads. It was all for people who had diabetes as well as gluten sensitivities. So that was also a learning experience. But I collaborated on that one. But then in this one, you know, the movement, the bread again hadn't gone away. And certainly the question for people who are gluten sensitive or wheat sensitive, not specifically celiac disease, but so many people, the other of the 5% of the people who were going gluten-free nationwide, and now let's say some people say there's 20% of people that are eating gluten-free, but most of them are doing it as a choice, not because they'll die if they eat gluten. So why are they sensitive? And so I started to explore sensitivities in general. Why are so many people so much more sensitive today than they used to be? And there's a lot of speculation. It can be environmental. It could be a lot of other things that we're doing to compromise our digestive systems, our microbiome, and all of those things. And what are some ways to maybe revisit bread so that if you do have sensitivities, you can eat them again without fear? Because for people who give up bread, one of the things they hate is giving up bread. I mean, they crave that way more than if they give up meat or something else. And so I, again, just through good luck, and relationships. A miller in North Carolina sent me a bag of flour that he had made with sprouted wheat.